Direct examination by a dermatologist remains the gold standard for the early detection of melanoma, and more than 3 million cases of skin cancer are diagnosed annually in the United States. While cutaneous melanoma accounts for less than 5% of all skin cancers, it can be aggressive and fatal if not detected and treated early. In our next dialogue, Dr. Deb Johnny-Sani and Dr. Maurice Thu discuss how we can help to prevent melanoma and spare our patients and the public from this dreaded disease.
Today it's my pleasure to talk to Dr. Deb Johnny-Sani. Dr. Sani is an assistant professor of dermatology at Boston University Medical Center and the director of the cutaneous oncology unit there. Welcome, Dr. John.
Thank you very much.
And what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about the sun. We're going to talk about sunscreen. We're going to talk about melanoma. We're going to talk about why we're still seeing so many. And what about the new sunscreen rules that have recently been promulgated? Dr. Sani, we are still seeing an enormous number of melanomas. People are using sunscreens, or they say they're using sunscreens, but the numbers still increase, and it's still very worrisome.
Good question. Unlike a lot of other cancers, melanoma over the last decade, unfortunately, has shown an increase in the incidence and mortality, as you've alluded to. And it may be to do with just the way life is now. The world is smaller, so people with fair skin are not necessarily in sort of colder climates. They're traveling abroad, they're going on vacation, they enjoy the sun. There's a lot of sunbed use, which is also contributing to melanomas. And people, even though there's all this knowledge about the bad effects of sun, I don't think people fully get it.
But we've known about melanoma for a very, very, very long time, and people are more protected than they were, but the numbers are still going up, aren't they? I mean, I think in the 1930s, the chance of having a melanoma in one's lifetime as a white person living in the United States was something like 1 in 1,500. By the year 2000, it was 1 in 74. Current trends, it's going to be 1 in 45 by the year 2020. And in Australia, it's 1 in 25. That's alarming, isn't it?
It's alarming. We need to do something about
that. Are we sure that it's the sun that's causing it?
Yes. I mean, the role of UV radiation in the development of melanoma is very well established. And it is in the people typically who have the fair skin. And I don't think people are protecting themselves enough from the sun. I think that is one key point.
Is it total sun exposure or acute blistering sunburns in childhood? Which is the more important?
Both, but certainly acute blistering sunburns in childhood does contribute to melanoma later on. That's one of the key risk factors.
Yeah. But what about other kinds of melanoma? What about melanomas in the eye, for example? Melanomas on the feet? Do you think sun plays a role there?
No, we don't. And they have different genetic mutations, and that's been demonstrated recently. So recent knowledge of the genetic aberrations in melanoma has been explosive, and we've learned a lot about the different mutations and the different pathways that are involved in melanoma. And the mutations that are involved in the sort of classic melanoma, as we know, are different to those that are involved in acral melanomas. They tend to be more the KIT mutations. Also in uveal melanomas, they're different. They're sort of QGNA11 mutations, whereas the mutations that we see in the classic melanomas are most commonly the BRAF mutations, also mutations in NRAS. So it suggests that there are different pathways.
Okay. But in terms of sun exposure, let's agree that the sun causes cancer.
Yeah, chronic prolonged sun exposure with basal cell cancers. With melanoma, it's the intense short bursts of sun exposure. Right. Yeah.
But since people are using sunscreens, why do you think we're still seeing as much melanoma?
We have to remember it's not the only way to protect against the sun. And whenever I counsel my patients, it's a three-way process. So it's avoiding excess sun exposure, avoiding the midday sun, staying in the shade, for example, wearing protective clothing and the sunscreens. But if you were to go and converse with people outside, most people will turn to sunscreens for sun protection. And they also don't do it very well. They don't do it correctly. So sunscreens were manufactured to be used at 2 mg/cm². That's how you get the SPF protection from UVB. But actually, people use somewhere between 0.5 and 1 mg/cm². So they're only getting about a third of what the SPF label on the bottle is. And I think another thing that people do is, as well as not applying it enough, they also don't apply it frequently enough. So sunscreens only last for a couple of hours, and patients typically don't reapply. There's also been another thing. People who tend to use sunscreens also are the ones who tend to go and overexpose themselves to the sun, whether that they intentionally were going to do that anyway, and that's why they're using the sunscreen, or whether they're also getting this feeling of being invincible from the sun because they have sunscreen on. So it's not being used appropriately.
What about some of the controversies? How about the vitamin D controversy? Where are we on that?
So there's been a lot of research in the last few years suggesting that as well as beneficial health to the musculoskeletal system, vitamin D may be helpful in preventing many cancers, autoimmune diseases, neurological, cardiovascular conditions. And the endogenous synthesis of vitamin D, the first step takes place in the skin. It's a UVB-induced 7-dehydrocholesterol to vitamin D3. So of course there's been concern that by using sunscreens we may be blocking this vitamin D and is that, you know, more unhealthy for us. But when we look at the studies in a control setting where they've done studies on subjects who put on sunscreen and then expose themselves to photolamps, yes, there is a suggestion that it does reduce vitamin D levels. But when you look in the real life setting, so for example, Marx et al. Did a study, a randomized control study looking at this, they actually weren't able to show significant differences in vitamin D levels between the sunscreen users and those that use a placebo cream. And again, I think it goes back to this thing that consumers don't apply sunscreens in the right way. And so they don't get the full benefits of the sunscreen, and so vitamin D levels are not significantly altered.
But a lot of people, the tanning industry, for example, are putting out the notion you should get some sun because you need your vitamin D, and there are so many people in this country who don't have enough. Instead, it's interesting.
But I will tell you that the Institute of Medicine looked into all these vitamin D studies, yeah, and they've yet to find any conclusive evidence that vitamin D is protective in all these other diseases that I've talked about. And the AAD stands by the fact that if people who are prone to vitamin D deficiency should supplement that orally and not through the sun.
Yeah, and it doesn't take much, actually.
It actually doesn't take much.
What about other things that have been blamed? Some people say, well, maybe they're getting as many melanomas because of the sunscreens. This has been said for years and years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Put that one to bed.
If we look back at the literature, there are many studies that show that there is no preventative effect of sunscreens with melanoma. There are even some that are more worrying that show that the melanoma may in fact increase with sunscreen use. But the problem with these studies, and in fact two meta-analyses were carried out that looked into these studies and failed to show that sunscreens had any preventative or harmful effect as regards to melanoma. So there's all this conflicting evidence in history, but there are multiple reasons why we have this conflicting data. First, the study designs were all retrospective analyses with which are prone to bias. They also didn't correct for confounding factors. You know, the reasons that make somebody use sunscreen are often the same reasons that make people prone to melanoma. For example, propensity to sunburn, family history of melanoma. And so in a non-randomized trial, it's difficult to differentiate between this. Also, a lot of these study designs were done with old generation sunscreens that had very low SPF values and little to no UVA protection. And again, I come back to that same theory that consumers don't use sunscreens in the right way, so they were never applying enough sunscreen. So how could it show a protective benefit?
It's been suggested, though, that retinal palmitate, for example, can cause problems, and so can oxybenzone. Is that true?
In vitro studies have shown that oxybenzone can be systemically absorbed, and also in vivo studies also. And if absorbed, they can have problems with anti-estrogen androgenic effects. But really, the true test of a human risk is to do a clinical study with human volunteers. And when this was done, they did show that oxybenzone can be systemically absorbed, but it's also excreted in the urine and doesn't accumulate in the plasma, and actually doesn't have the hormonal disruption that was feared. So all this worry with oxybenzone, when you take it in the context of humans, is actually not worrying.
Okay, what about the retinal palmitate?
So again, with retinal palmitate, there have been studies that have, in vitro studies and in vivo studies, that have shown that it may have developed reactive oxygen species. And of course, these have mutagenic potential, and this has led to a lot of concerns. When they did in vivo studies with mice, they were unable to show this photocarcinogenic effect. And although we don't have any human studies with retinal palmitate, we have evidence from 40 years of use of retinal palmitate, both topically and systemically, and we don't have any evidence to show that it's photocarcinogenic. So all these concerns, yes, maybe in an in vitro setting, maybe worrying, but when you look at it in the context of humans, it's not so worrying.
But a lot of that discussion in terms of the retinoids causing cancer, it was 30, 40 years ago this came about. It was thought that when they did experiments on nude mice, that they had a greatly increased incidence of cancer, but they were burning them. And in fact, if they used the retinoid without burning the mouse, it seemed to protect against cancer, which was all this business about using
exactly.
The retinoids now.
So the studies, yeah, you have to take into context the results of the studies. Were they done in the appropriate way? Can they be related to what happens in humans? For example, these reactive oxygen species do get produced. However, in the human skin, we have an antioxidant complex network which can quench these reactive oxygen species. And in vitro, it's very difficult to replicate that network. And so, you know, it's not meaningful, the results in a human context.
Isn't it true, though, there haven't been many new sunscreens brought into the United States? There are multiple sunscreens used in Europe and Asia that are not used in the United States.
These are yet to come, yet to be approved by the FDA. Yes, that is true, what you're saying.
Maxaril is one, I think, for example. That was just introduced. It's the first new sunscreen in many years, isn't that correct?
Yes.
The old business of UVA and UVB, they don't use that anymore.
No, they feel like that's confusing to customers. So the SPF is for UVB testing, as we know. And then the UVA is labeled with the word broad spectrum. So only if it passes the critical wavelength test can their sunscreen use the word broad spectrum. So the way I counsel my patients, because they often will ask you in clinic, what is the best sunscreen to use?
Yes.
I will always say, look at the sunscreen label. It has to have the words broad spectrum written on it and an SPF of 30 or more.
Now, previously they were recommending 15, then later 30. But if you look, if you go into the stores, you can find things labeled 100.
Yes.
Isn't it better to use 100 than a 30? Because the public's confused on this.
Yes. The FDA feel that above 50, there is very little extra benefit to gain. And so they're actually thinking about capping the SPF at 50. The other reason that the FDA want to cap it is also because they feel that the higher the SPF, it gives the consumer a false sense of security and an over-reliance on the sunscreen. And they want to pull away from that. And it comes back to that point that I mentioned, that sunscreens shouldn't be the only way to protect yourself from the sun. It should be one of many ways, including sun avoidance and protective clothing.
What about some of the newer chemicals that are used in sunscreen? How about nanotechnology, for example? What's the situation of that?
The nanotechnologies come into play with the use of titanium dioxide and zinc oxide, which have been used as inorganic filters in sunscreens for many, many years. They're excellent sunscreen agents. But the problem with titanium dioxide and zinc oxide is that they're very large particles. And so when they're used in sunscreens, they're poorly dispersive and they leave a white, opaque screen on the skin, which is cosmetically unacceptable to a lot of consumers. So over the years, these particle sizes have been minimized now into this nano range, which means less than 100 nanometers. And this has led to two worries. Number one, if the particle size is minimized, does that then lead to systemic absorption through the skin? And number two, it's well known that nano-sized particles have different biological properties to their standard-sized particles. And so these have been looked into. So there have been some rigorous testing done under stressful conditions, and they have yet to show that these nano-sized particles pass through the stratum corneum in the skin. And the reason for this is nanoparticles exist as aggregates, which are more than 100 nanometers in diameter. And so
they clump together, basically.
Yeah. They aggregate, and these aggregates are unable to penetrate through the stratum corneum. And when they looked at the toxicology studies, they failed to show that these nano-sized particles were toxic. So they're not even being passed through the skin.
Now, can sunscreens be in any kind of a base? Because some of them come in emulsions, some of them come in liquids, solutions, creams. Are they all acceptable by the FDA or not?
The FDA has been quite clear on what is acceptable. It is lotions, creams, sprays. However, there's sunscreens that are available as sort of tissue wipes, as body washes, and those are not acceptable. And the FDA are also looking into the spray form of sunscreens, because they're not so great for two reasons. Number one, they don't give as good a coverage as a cream or a lotion would. And also there's this worry about inhalation of this, and then they are going into your system and what's happening to you then.
Well, that's particularly true with nanoparticles, though, right?
Exactly.
I mean, one would have to be concerned about
The FDA are looking into it. I have to say, when my patients come to clinic, I'll always tell them not to go for the spray. I personally feel that it's not good to go for the sprays.
Sunscreens that contain nanoparticles clearly labeled as having nanoparticles?
I don't think so.
They should be, don't you think? What do you think?
Curious. Because you put in the words nanoparticle, then it leads on to this worry and concern, which we've proven isn't a problem. So in a way, they probably doesn't need to have the words nanoparticle on it.
What does waterproof mean with the sunscreen, new sunscreen rules?
So they're not allowed to use the word waterproof anymore, because again, the FDA feel it gives the consumer this false security that their sunscreen is everlasting. And so they have to use the words water resistant 40 minutes or 80 minutes. And that gives the consumer clear guidelines as to exactly how long their sunscreen is useful for and when it needs to be reapplied.
What about the use in children? Are there guidelines on that?
So the FDA say that below the age of 6 months, you should ask your physician whether to use a sunscreen. And we as physicians don't have guidelines as what to do. But when my patients ask me, you know, a baby, I would say at least less than a year old, whose skin hasn't necessarily developed as fully as an older child, there are other ways of protecting from the sun. That child doesn't have to have sunscreen slathered on them.
It shouldn't be in the sun in the first place.
In the first place, or they can stay in the shade, they can have protective. Right. There's many ways that you can do that with a baby. I think once they're over the age of a year, there's no reason not to use sunscreen. Certainly preschool children and school children who are out about in the sun during recreation, I think it's important to use sunscreen.
It would seem unnecessary for a baby to have
a
sunburn.
That's my point. I think we don't have all the necessary evidence, my personal feeling would be not to use them, as there are other methods for sun protecting.
But some of the other things like the wipes and so on, they're not acceptable.
They're not acceptable anymore, no. Okay.
But you're comfortable that if people use sunscreen properly,
yes,
and they use the good sunscreens properly labeled,
yes,
that it really will have an effect on the development of melanoma in the future, that there will be fewer.
It will help to prevent melanomas, and this randomized controlled trial by Green et al. Actually did show that. The risk reduction was 50% in melanomas, and this was more pronounced in the invasive melanomas. It was about 73% risk reduction. So yes, we need more similar trials to corroborate the data, but we know that UV radiation leads to melanoma, and so it would make sense that if you prevent this, whether it's with using sunscreens or sun avoidance, ideally all those methods, it will reduce melanoma, yes. At least the sun-induced melanomas. We have
right.
to clarify that.
Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Right. But you're pretty certain if people are careful and they really use good sunscreens and sun protection in the way that we've discussed, there will be a lot less melanoma.
I believe so. And also the tanning industry. We need to let people know the harmful effects of tanning. We're up against a problem here because, like you mentioned earlier, the tanning industry will show beneficial effects of tanning, which are unfounded, but people are not aware of.
The numbers are worrisome. Apparently, regular use of a tanning booth increases one's chances of melanoma by 75%.
I think every time a person visits a tanning salon, the risk goes up by about 2% with each visit.
That's extraordinary, isn't
it? It is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As mentioned before, melanoma is one of the most rapidly growing cancers worldwide, and the incidence has been steadily rising since the 1970s, with an increase of approximately 3-7% per year. This alarming rise is associated with an increased mortality rate as well. The development of melanoma is multifactorial, with contributions from environmental, host, and genetic factors. Exposure to ultraviolet radiation, or UVR, seems to be a critical and modifiable environmental risk factor. UVR is divided into UVA, UVB, and UVC. The UVR that is able to penetrate the ozone layer and reach our skin is 90-95% UVA and 5-10% UVB. The role of ultraviolet radiation in the etiology of melanoma is supported by several studies. Living closer to the equator has been consistently associated with increased risks of developing melanoma, presumably because of increased exposure to UVR. Several studies have demonstrated a significant correlation between lower latitude, greater mean UVR index, and increased risk of melanoma. A New Zealand study reported that for each degree in latitude closer to the equator, there was a 5% increased risk of melanoma. Migration studies provide additional evidence in support of this association. A case-control study found that individuals immigrating to Australia after the age of 15 years had approximately 1/4 of the risk of developing melanoma, whereas those who arrived prior to age 10 years had a similar risk as those born in Australia. A recent randomized controlled trial examined regular sunscreen use in residents of Queensland, Australia. This pivotal study demonstrated a reduction in melanoma incidence, as well as a substantial reduction in the number of invasive melanomas in the group assigned to daily rather than discretionary sunscreen use. In contrast to the chronic prolonged UVR exposure that is associated with increased risk of both basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma, it seems to be intense, brief exposure to UVR that is associated with increased risk of melanoma. Tanning bed use is one example of this type of intense UVR exposure. A recent systematic review and meta-analysis based on 27 studies found a dose-response relationship wherein there was a 1.8% increased risk of melanoma with each individual tanning session. Many patients may not realize that sun protection takes several forms. Avoiding the sun from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. when the UVR emitted is most intense can reduce exposure tremendously. Wearing protective clothing, wide-brim hats made of tightly woven material, and sunglasses that block UVA and UVB are excellent options. Lastly, patients must be advised to use broad-spectrum SPF 30+ sunscreens. SPF refers to protection from UVB. Broad-spectrum means that the sunscreen passed a standardized critical wavelength test for UVA protection. Unfortunately, most people use sunscreen incorrectly. They apply too little, and they usually do not reapply, which means that their actual SPF is a fraction of what the bottle advertises, leaving their skin vulnerable. Despite numerous large campaigns designed to raise awareness of sun safety, we continue to observe poor adherence with these recommendations. Studies have shown, and many of us know from experience, that increased awareness and knowledge does not always translate into behavior change in our patients. The onus remains on physicians to target the populations at highest risk and determine their attitudes, beliefs, and barriers to change. Tailoring our interventions in this way may lead to the changes we seek in patient adherence to sun safety recommendations, with a coincident decrease in melanoma incidence and mortality.